If they move, kill them.
And now.
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way.
Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour Top 10 with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Well, where does that go? I mean, really, is that over that?
This is Phil Lernis.
I got my top five.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Phil Lernis. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. And what you probably hear is Dean Haglund struggling with the concept of numbering when it comes to a top 10 list.
See? No, that's just wrong.
All right. This is, as listeners know, and even first-time listeners probably have figured out because... the show opened with William Holden from The Wild Bunch and then Frankie Lane's terrific theme song to Blazing Saddles. This is our top 10 Westerns of all time.
Woohoo!
Oh my God.
That's all I got.
You just became, oh my God, Walter Brennan from Rio Bravo, I think. Are you limping around on your one leg there?
I got to make him five mess of beans. Didn't he?
We did just find the old West character you would have played.
I know. I'm a young Walter Brennan.
Oh my God. I'm either like the judge that comes into town, or I'm the local newspaperman.
Yeah, you're either the newspaper guy with the spectacles that someone gets shot in the middle while reporting on the shootout, or you're the snake oil salesman that just comes through town and whisks off with a local beauty.
That's true. All right. I sign up for all of those. Okay. listen, I know this is odd, but let's quickly define this if we can. Let's set some parameters when we say Western movies, because the truth is... you will find a wide array of movies if you ever Google like best Western movies of all time. And so I'm going to suggest to you, and at least, look, you can make your own damn list. You're capable of doing it.
Right.
This is what I followed. I followed the definition that the American Film Institute, used, which was, to define the Western as a genre of film set in the American West that embodies the spirit, the struggle, and the demise of the new frontier. And why I point this out and why I used this definition was that it eliminates, therefore, some films that I love, don't kid yourself, but that I don't actually consider a Western, certainly with this definition. Films like Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Right. Now, that was the one on my list that could not be a Western, because it has all the...
it has many of the components, but...
Many of the components.
But set in the 1920s.
Right.
Right?
But it's a frontier. They're out in the frontier of Mexico, theoretically.
The Mexican frontier, not the frontier of the American West. Okay. Bad Day at Black Rock often gets considered a Western. Here's a movie set in the 1950s. No Country for Old Men is considered a Western. Not qualifying under this definition. And the recent Hell or High Water, which even I called a Western, not a Western given this definition. But they're all masterpieces, and you should see all of them. In fact, do so now, and then we will complete the show.
See what you did?
Now, did you have any of those on your list?
None of them were on my list, thankfully, because, you know, my experience, of course, in Canada watching American Westerns, and my dad always pointed this out, is that it's unique that justice comes at the end of an individual gun in a lot of these things. and particularly the bad ones, you know, the ones that didn't have any thought-provoking thing to it, but just was sort of the standard high noon showdown and shots fired, and then there's some chasing of a wagon train and the slaughter of indigenous people, you know, that kind of thing.
Well,
those thoughtless ones.
Yeah,
that's sort of off my list.
Well, this is what I think is interesting about us doing this. You being Canadian and now living in Australia and getting to know that culture, and their cultures that have unique points of view on the American Western, because in some ways the mythos of the American Westerns resonate with Canada and with Australia, as we discussed last week, especially with Australia. And in other ways, of course, there's going to be a way that you come to it that is a different point of view culturally. So I think that's interesting, us doing this. I want to say, why, when we're doing top 10, we're trying to do 10 top 10 shows, because this is our 10th year of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. So why Westerns? And I would say that Westerns matter, because, you know, you'll meet people who go, I don't like Westerns. And my response is, well, wait, you haven't heard why they matter. And once you've heard why they matter, grow up, get a male role model, and start to watch some Westerns.
Get a male role model. So, that's hilarious.
They matter if we can say that any art and storytelling matters at all. Okay?
Right.
If it matters, they matter, because they deal in a uniquely American way with issues involving the individual versus society, man versus his own nature, and they require literacy on the part of the audience, visual literacy. And why? Because their meaning, because their ideas are best expressed and found subtextually and in the margins of genre convention.
Right. So you can show the movie strictly on an entertaining aspect of good guy, bad guy, shots fired.
But the level where the themes live require literacy on the part of the audience. So so it requires something of an audience, and it expresses something of what it means to be specifically a human struggling with those mythological concepts in the very specific American psyche.
Right. Very specific.
Do you have any honorable mention?
Yeah, you know what hung in the auspices for me was 1953 Shane. I've seen this so many times, and I still have trouble with it. This is
Alan Ladd. Alan Ladd's
Alan
signature
Ladd. I was gonna
role.
Say Alan sure. Kidd. Yeah, Alan Ladd, and he's the gunfighter, the reluctant gunfighter who only starts fighting and punching when he has to. And of course he's idolized by a young child who also gets caught up in the male role model, but also in the violence, you know, as he starts eating his candy, crunching it every time Shane punches somebody. And each time I see this, I go, yeah, you know, he's supposed to be at the level where he is just has to fight. But from my perspective, he could still step back a bit. I mean, he seems to be a little quick to the punch, from my perspective.
Fascinating. I might want to watch this again at some point. It's not on my list, but I think it's interesting that you would acknowledge that the merits of the film, and yet maybe the problem that you're having with it comes from your unique perspective.
Exactly. It's not resonating as much as probably would for someone else.
Well, and this is why it's going to be interesting. I know for a fact one movie that is on your list, because we discussed it a little bit before we started recording, and it's my honorable mention. Now, this is in addition to both the Westerns I talked about last week on the show, Winchester 73 and The Gunfighter, both of which are outstanding and deserve honorable mention. But I covered them last week. But the one that I wanted to bring up this time, and I'll hold off on talking about it too much because I get the strong feeling we'll be talking about it a little bit later on. But that's Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles. And I when we did horror films, Young Frankenstein was my honorable mention, much like right. Cabin in the Woods was yours, because I just, in the case of Blazing Saddles, it relies, I don't know, it kind of stands astride the genre, if that makes sense. It stands,
yeah, because he's taken the genre tropes to tell a contemporary story or explore contemporary issues. That, of course, of race.
Yeah, and also other genres as well. And there's so many malapropisms and anachronisms, and it's hysterically funny. But I couldn't in good conscience put it on one of the 10 best Westerns because I see it standing aside Westerns. And yet, I got to tell you, when I first came to it as a kid, I didn't just love it because it was funny. I also actually loved it as an exciting cowboy story. So maybe right. I've just grown a little bit too sophisticated for my own good. But nevertheless, that's my honorable mention. Why don't we start with number 10, Dean Haglund?
Well, my number 10 is a flawed Western that originally was going to be directed by Stanley Kubrick. And who replaced him as director? Marlon Brando. And this is One-Eyed Jacks, 1961. Have you seen this ever?
Oh, of course I have. And it's interesting yes. that the rule did not change because of this, but there was a rule that the Directors Guild adopted later on, and I'm trying to remember what film I learned this about, but I think it was maybe a Western. But the DGA would later adopt a rule so that actors could not take over for directors who left or were fired or whatever eventually. But yes, I have seen it. It's an interesting movie.
It's an interesting movie. I think the acting is phenomenal. I think there was probably an edit in there that would have been much more nuanced than what actually finally came about. And from what I had read, the script also, Rod Serling wrote the first draft, and Sam Peckinpah hired to do rewrites on this thing.
Wow.
So I know.
Quite a lot of pedigree there.
A lot of pedigree, and yet you could see where it kind of falls apart, probably because Marlon Brando is just focusing, you know, his work method as an actor is long, laborious, and improvisational. I'm sure his directing method was as searching, I believe the term is, as well. So One-Eyed Jacks is my number 10.
I have a two-way tie for number 10 that kind of, to me, embody the yin-yang of Western films without managing the complete package. The first mm-hmm. is The Oxbow Incident from 1943.
Yeah.
Directed by William Wellman, starring Henry Fonda, Dana Andrews, Henry Morgan, Frank Conroy, Anthony Quinn. What a cast. And what it really embodies is how Westerns could, in a very unique, entertaining way, wrestle with some really thorny issues of ethics. And in this case, legal justice, as two drifters are passing through a Western town when news comes in that a local farmer has been murdered and his cattle stolen. The townspeople, joined by the drifters, form a posse to catch the perpetrators, and they basically try them themselves. And if they find them guilty, this posse, they're going to hang them out there. Look, I'm going to spoil alert the fuck out of this, so stop playing now or jump ahead a little bit if you don't want to know what happens, and actually stop playing a while ago if you don't want to hear me drop an F-bomb. So they find them guilty, they hang them, and then word comes in that it turns out the farmer wasn't killed after all. It was all a misunderstanding. So everything these people have been saying was rightful. So it's about some really heavy concepts about justice and right. The importance of a legal justice system where one dissenting voice hangs a jury, because these drifters and a few others in the posse vote against their guilt, but they go by democracy rules. And democracy rules in this movie is the same thing as saying mob rule, and that justice should never be a game of democracy. It needs to be a search for the truth. So it's a very complicated film about thorny issues. It is powerful as all get out. But as a Western, it's almost marginally a Western. It's almost a play that could have been set in any kind of setting. On the other hand, tied with that, I have The Professionals from 1966, Richard Brooks' film starring another great cast, Burt Lancaster, Lee Marvin, Robert Ryan, Woody Strode, one of three movies with Woody Strode that I'm going to discuss, Ralph Bellamy, Jack Palance, and Claudia Cardinale. That is an all-star Western lineup. And it takes place in the latter part of the Mexican Revolution, where an American rancher hires four men who are experts in their respective fields to rescue his kidnapped wife, who's been brought back over to the Mexican side of the border by a former Mexican revolutionary leader turned bandit. It received critical acclaim and huge box office and three Oscar nominations when it came out. But it doesn't really have a lot on its mind. Right? This film, certainly not the way that the other films on my list will and the way that a movie like The Oxbow Incident does. It's a heck of a lot of fun. And it still matters now because for Burt Lancaster and Richard Brooks, The Professionals was a metaphor to them for filmmaking. And how filmmaking, they thought, by the end of the 60s, was in really great jeopardy in terms of the professionalism of it. And the 60s were a rough decade for American Hollywood filmmaking. And then, of course, that would be salvaged by the best decade ever, the 70s. But they made this movie as a metaphor for the importance of professionalism in storytelling, in filmmaking. And one could argue today it resonates when we have such a lack of professionalism in business, entertainment, and politics. The message is resonant and rewarding, but there aren't great themes involved. Nevertheless, Professionals, Oxbow Incident, tie for my number 10. Here's a little taste of The Professionals.
Look at this.
You bastard.
Yes, sir. In my case, an accident of birth. But you, sir, you're a self-made man.
What's your number nine, Dean Haglund?
Well, my number nine sits at, I got to say, the 1960 version of The Magnificent Seven, which, of course, is the remake of The Samurai Seven done in a Western. This is Yul Brynner, Eli Wallach, Steve McQueen, James Coburn, Robert Vaughn. I mean, think of that as the poor Mexican town who hires the seven gunslingers to save the day. This I always
Did you mention Bronson? Did you mention Charles Bronson?
How about Bronson?
Introducing Horace Buchholz, Brad Dexter, great character. Yeah, Eli Wallach. Yeah. I mean, just outstanding ensemble work. But please continue.
No. So this is the one I remember seeing as a kid at the drive-in. So it was one that you could totally get into. And John Sturges directed, of course, who did Great Escape and Bad Day at Black Rock. You're runner up. So all around, that's my number nine, Magnificent Seven. I haven't seen the remake. Have you?
No, I have not. Yeah. Magnificent Seven in 2013, like so many of these films we're discussing, was added for preservation to the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. We've talked about this before on the show. It's interesting to me how it was neither a hit nor critically acclaimed when it was first released. It quickly became such a popular favorite that it's hard to imagine that it was a bomb on its... I mean, it came and went. Like, nobody even heard about this thing. And it was success in Europe and Japan that saved the film by inspiring distributors to maybe change the ad campaign a little bit and give it another chance in theaters here. And re-releases are what enabled the film to find a box office success. When I say that it was not critically acclaimed, Dean, I found this quote from the original New York Times review.
Oh.
Calling The Magnificent Seven a pallid, pretentious, and overlong reflection of the Japanese original. First of all, this thing is so fast-paced and moving. It is not overlong at all. Somehow they manage on a really tight timeline to give all these characters their own arcs, all these actors their own moments, which is why guys like Bronson and Coburn and Steve McQueen became stars, even though they were playing supporting roles. Yeah. And pretentious? What is it? Where is the pretense? What is it pretending to be that it is not?
It's pretending to be the Samurai Seven. Maybe that's the pretension. Is that?
Yeah, somebody just said, "How dare you trifle with the Seven Samurai?" You know why I think it matters now, in addition to just being so much fun, is that I think, you know, I love ensemble movies. And
yes.
And I think true ensemble storytelling is desperately needed in this society. We see it on stage. We don't see it enough in movies because a lot of times the economics don't support it in movies.
Right.
But it's important for audiences to see ensemble stories being told, to see that teamwork matters, to see that art, just like life, is not meant to be a competitive sport with anyone other than yourself. Can you achieve your own unique best? And can you combine that unique best that you have to offer with the unique best that the person next to you has to offer? And that's what the Magnificent Seven is about. And it's also what getting to see a movie like that is about. Codes of conduct matter. Redemption matters. And teamwork is often the doorway to learn about both codes of conduct and redemption.
Absolutely. And that the solution to the problem is a third path. It's not my way or the highway, like in a lot of these cowboy movies. It is this group coming together to find a solution that could only be solved by the seven of them coming together as an ensemble.
Magnificent Seven, Dean Haglund's number nine. That, of course, is Elmer Bernstein's terrific theme song to The Magnificent Seven. My number nine is the original 1957 version of 3:10 to Yuma.
Oh, really?
Directed by Delmer Daves. This is full-on merging of film noir and Western, starring Glenn Ford, a great film noir star. Van Heflin, a great film noir star. Also, wonderful supporting work from especially a couple of women, Felicia Farr and Laura Donna, and the great Richard Jekyll, who often turned up as villains or key tough guy supporting actors in Westerns and war films, like playing Lee Marvin's sidekick in The Dirty Dozen. It's almost, like I said, a film noir Western with its black and white, expressive black and white cinematography. And who better to star in that, therefore, than Glenn Ford? It was based on a 1953 short story by Elmore Leonard. So think about its tough guy bona fides right there.
Oh, yeah.
It's about a drought-impoverished rancher. So already when asking the question, why would this film matter to contemporary audiences? It's about a drought impoverished rancher who takes on the risky job of escorting a notorious outlaw to justice. Again, like all these other films on the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress in 2012, because it was deemed, as all these were, as culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. When it was first released in the summer of 57, the film became quite popular among audiences and critics alike because of how suspenseful it was and for its sharp black and white cinematography, i.e. Nice. Like it was a noir. And Glenn Ford received particular notice for being cast against type. It's a villainous performance, and Glenn Ford never was more interesting. He was so reliable as a hero, but never as interesting when he played this villain. The following year, 1958, 310 to Yuma was nominated for the British Academy of Film and Television Arts Award for Best Film. And I got to tell you, at a time today when more and more people are living in poverty, living paycheck to paycheck, and seem to be one bad month from losing their homes, this story of a man choosing virtue in the face of hunger, honor in the face of death, because a world worth living for is the only one worth fighting for, I think that's a story that will move audiences today as it did then. As it does, Glenn Ford's villain. The imagine that. It's a film where ultimately the plight and story and heroism of protagonist Van Heflin is what changes the behavior of the film's villain.
Look at that.
It's also one of the closest that any classic era Westerns comes to being a feminist film. So anyway, number nine, 310 to Yuma. What's your number eight?
Well, my number eight, my number eight is a bit embarrassing, I suppose, because it's Jack Lemmon in Cowboy. Now, he plays a Chicago hotel clerk who he worships all the cowboys coming in from riding the range and delivering the cattle to the Chicago. And as a twist of fate, he himself has to ride back with all the cowboys and realizes that all these guys are not the virtuous men of the plain, but just louts and losers who are on the horse. And he, of course, is the one that has all the virtue. And it's kind of funny. But it's a guilty pleasure. It's my one guilty pleasure of all the Westerns on my list.
Well, that's interesting. I've never even heard of this film, and I look forward to actually seeing this, because I mean, I get something about all out of all Westerns. I really do.
Yeah.
Because again, this is a genre where the meaning is found in the margins. And so the more you explore the form, the better able you are to read the form. But I would say thematically that it actually has a kinship to my number eight, which is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Oh, yeah.
From 1962. And this is directed by John Ford, stars John Wayne, James Stewart, Vera Miles, Lee Marvin. This name keeps coming up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Edmund O'Brien, Woody Strode. Second Woody Strode film, Jeanette Nolan, John Carradine, Lee Van Cleef. There's another actor I'm going to be discussing later. So what a cast. And I would argue the last true classic for not only John Ford, who was considered really by generations of filmmakers the greatest American filmmaker. It was also the last classic for John Wayne and James Stewart, I would argue.
Yeah,
and in 2007, like all the others, National Film Registry. But the reason I say that it's kinship is the film is told in flashback as a senator played by James Stewart and his wife attend a funeral in the frontier town of Shinbone. And the senator finds himself interviewed about why he would attend a local rancher's funeral. And so in flashback, we see how the senator first ever arrived as a young lawyer in Shinbone. He was an idealistic attorney. His stagecoach gets robbed by a gang of outlaws led by Liberty Valance. And when Jimmy Stewart comes to the defense of a widow who's being robbed of her heirlooms by Valance, he's brutally whipped and left for dead. And John Wayne's character finds him, brings him into town, sets him up with a family, the family of his intended, of his affianced, and they nurse him back to health. And in the process, his affianced falls in love with Jimmy Stewart, and that turns out to be the senator's wife. And so it tells the whole origin story of how he came to Shinbone and how he developed the legend for being the man who shot Liberty Valance, a legend upon which his entire political career is based. The only problem being he wasn't the man who shot Liberty Valance.
Right. And, spoiler alert.
And, well, but that's not really. But,
no, I know.
But so why it matters now is, you know, we build the world we live in through the stories we choose to believe.
Absolutely.
Right? Legends, legends matter. Myths matter if they are instructive of fundamental truths. Behind every political leader, no matter how, you know, no matter who that political leader is, no matter how much you might love them or hate them, behind every political leader are ordinary men and women who are making that person's heroism or villainy possible.
Right.
And this is what Man Who Shot Liberty Valance explores. And so I find it interesting that there's a movie with Jack Lemmon, such an all-American male figure that we think represents kind of the best in us, like a Jimmy Stewart, who's taking that journey to explore the ideals of the heroes he admires and finds out that they're somewhat less. They're much more flawed people than those legends would have him believe.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
So
your
well, that was my number eight, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Your number seven.
Right. My number seven, we talked about it already. It's Blazing Saddles. Taking all of those tropes, every thing, and putting it on its head in a hilarious comedy that is a Western and an entertaining Western as well. The sheriff, black sheriff and white sidekick, and all the adventures that happened to those two.
Well, you,
every scene's funny. I mean,
every scene is funny, and it plays on so many levels. If you love movies, it's a great parody of movies and of movie making and the artificiality of movie making. And it is such a wonderful, it's why I really wrestled with whether or not to have it on there, because it's not a Western so much as it's a movie. But, you know, it's about movies more than it being a story of the Old West. It's a story about movies rather than a story of the Old West. It's a story about how movies depict America. But again, for all of that, the story's actually exciting. Gene Wilder is such a great parody of the gunslinger, and yet you love him as a gunslinger.
Yeah, yeah. It's so good. And I didn't realize how much Richard Pryor worked on the screen.
Yeah, he was a writer, and he was supposed to play the lead, and the studio would not have it, would not allow him.
Right, would not have it. Yeah, and as Mel Brooks talks about it, the studio notes were, can that sheriff be a white guy, and can we cut out the fart scene around the campfire?
Right.
Like those two things. That's where his major notes and his fight with the studio.
My number seven, we've already discussed, I just put it in an appropriate place. I didn't know where to put it, and then I realized, wait, the number seven is in the title. So let's put the Magnificent Seven at number seven. We won't talk about it anymore, but instead, here's one of my favorite quotes, and to me, it's the moment that makes, not the knife scene, it's the moment that makes James Coburn a tough guy movie star.
Nobody throws me my own guns and says run. Nobody.
What's your number six, Dean Haglund?
Well, my number six comes in at...
At number six.
Well, at number six, of course. It is it's a classic. We've talked about it on previous shows. And it's Gary Cooper, directed by Fred Zimmerman. It's High Noon. The marshal who's personally compelled to face that returning deadly enemy, the gang, coming to town. And the whole town refuses to help him, so he alone has to marshal down the street by himself and face these guys at the high noon part. And I love that it's actually told in real time. Like the minutes that are ticking to 12 noon are in the actual number of frames in the movie.
Well, it's then when you know, when you see a clock on the wall, okay, the bad guys will be there in 40 minutes. You know that in the movie, you've got 40 minutes until they show up. It unfolds in real time, that ticking clock, and those clocks are in every scene. And that was not by design. Isn't that right? That was something they discovered in editing.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing that they just luckily had that in? It seems improbable when you hear about it, but when you read the making of it, that was just luck.
Well,
so.
What I love about this is now we get into some of the nitty gritty of talking about how Westerns are political and how you find their difference through approach and style and technique, not necessarily through overt thematic expression. Rio Bravo is my number six. And it was 1959. Another great director like Fred Zinnemann, right? Howard Hawks.
Right.
Another great star, John Wayne. And it was made by John Wayne and Howard Hawks directly as a response to not only a film they hated in High Noon, but a film they found reprehensible on a political level.
Right.
So they decided to make Rio Bravo. The film also stars Dean Martin, Ricky Nelson, Walter Brennan, Angie Dickinson, Ward Bond, Claude Akins, a great script by Jules Furthman, and of course, Lee Brackett, a woman who also wrote Big Sleep, wrote Long Goodbye for Altman, wrote Empire Strikes Back. So a woman who knew her genre specifics, right? It on the National Film Registry as well. It's been the inspiration for such films as John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13.
Of course.
In 2012, Sight and Sound, the British Film Institute's magazine, named Rio Bravo the second greatest Western of all time. The basic premise, similar to that of High Noon, in the town of Rio Bravo, this sheriff arrests a man in the wake of a murder, and it's up to him and his alcoholic deputy and his one-legged deputy to stave off the entire gang, outlaw gang, that's going to come to rescue him before the before reinforcements can arrive sent by the U.S. Marshals. And the first significant difference is that many people in the town offer their assistance. Unlike in High Noon, where the sheriff seeks assistance and no one will help him, here people offer it, and the sheriff turns it down because it's not their job to put their lives on the line. It's his. That's why he's paid. His job is to keep them out of harm's way at all cost.
Right.
So a man doing his job does not accept the kind offers of assistance, because that's
from civilians.
That's the America that Hawks and Wayne believed existed, as opposed to the America that Zinnemann believed existed. Who's right? Who's wrong? You can debate that all the way around. But what's great about it is, instead of it being a political debate online as it would be today in know, or on Twitter or anything like that, it's like, you know what, I'm gonna tell a story that's gonna make people think about this theme differently, and not only
the
in terms
of perspective,
not only in terms of plot, but then also in terms of our approach. Instead of black and white, solarized black and white, we're gonna do lush Technicolor. Instead of it being a taut 80-minute movie or whatever, we're going to have it be a really leisurely paced film, so leisurely paced that there's even room for a couple of songs.
The sun is sinking in the west. The cattle go down to the stream. The red wing settles in her nest. It's time for a cowboy to dream. Purple eyes in the canyon, that's where I long to be with my three. good companion. Just my rifle holding and me gonna hang my sombrero on the limb of a tree coming home. Sweetheart, darling, just my rifle, pony, and me.
Whippoorwill in the willow sings a sweet melody.
Riding to
Amarillo.
Just my rifle, pony, and me.
No more cow.
To be roping.
No more stray. Will I see
Round the bend. She'll be waiting. For my rifle, pony, and me. My rifle, my pony, and me.
What is your number five, Dean Haglund?
Well, my number five, this is a wrestle between two Sergio Leone films, both of which I loved. But I think I'm going to come down with... they're both so good, but I'm going to... throw Good, Bad, and the Ugly under the bus for Once Upon a Time in the West, I think.
Well, I'm glad on a show where we're going wildly over time that we got to hear the decision-making process instead of you doing this before the show. But I'm glad that number five is Once Upon a Time in the West, because number five, for me, is a movie called Once Upon a Time in the West.
Look at that. So there you go. And isn't this a great movie?
Again, starring the beautiful, the exceptionally beautiful Claudia Cardinale. Henry Fonda. Jason,
as a bad guy.
Jason Robards, Charles Bronson. Numerous great cameos, including, Woody Strode. And Jack Elam as two of the three gunmen who are sent to kill Bronson in the opening. You know that, of course, this film was supposed to star Clint Eastwood. And ultimately, he declined to do it. And then they designed that opening sequence with the three assassins to be Eastwood, Eli Wallach, and Lee Van Cleef, to have it be the good and the bad and the ugly coming to kill this new hero. And Clint Eastwood said, "Are you crazy? I am never playing a villain. And I don't die. Hilarious. And I don't die in a movie." So, anyway, which he would not do, I think, until Gran Torino, right? He would never play a character who would die in a movie until then. And honestly, in real life, clearly, Clint Eastwood is never going to die. Anyway, I'm glad you picked this one because it's an epic spaghetti western from the master, and yet originally a flop. Unlike The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which was a huge hit, this was a flop. And it's now not only generally acknowledged as a masterpiece, one of the greatest films ever in 2009 being put on the National Film Registry. But directors from Quentin Tarantino, Martin Scorsese, George Lucas, John Carpenter, John Borman have all spoken about this film being a major, major influence on them.
Wow, that's amazing. And think of the writers on this one, of course. That's Bertolucci, co-writer on this. And music by Ennio Morricone.
Morricone, yeah.
Morricone. So fantastic.
You know, I always find Leone's films to be like Greek comedies and tragedies, both.
Yes,
About the primal, energetic building blocks of Western culture. And so they're absorbing and they're feverish. And ultimately, they're really cathartic. Like great Greek tragedy, great Greek drama. This film is about two separate conflicts that are both so mythic that take place around Flagstone, a fictional town. There's a land battle related to construction of a railroad and a mission of vengeance against a cold-blooded killer. And it's the interesting way in which these two seemingly unrelated stories cross that is... so delightful and kind of comedic, you know, kind of ironic and comedic.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, I always love Westerns that have the introduction of the railroad as a gloss of what was and an embrace of what the future is. And it's every technology that we have in our lives, be it the iPhone, the laptop, has a resonance to the idea of the railroad coming across the Western plain, and that the horse and the cowboy will soon be extinct. And this has all of that resonating all the way through it.
Well, it's an interesting thing. It is an interesting symbol because it gets played both ways sometimes. It might be the end to the lawlessness that is allowed to run rampant, right? It might be the ultimate symbol of the civilizing force that tames the West. Or in other films, it might literally be the moment when the promise of American liberty goes off the rails.
Interesting, right?
So it's like with all these Westerns, these symbols you think you know, be very careful about what the relationship that particular symbol has in the storyteller's hands. What's your number four, Dean Haglund?
Well, my number four, of course, is not only a Western, but probably the very essence of buddy movies. It's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid with Paul Newman and Robert Redford. And, of course, the weird Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head musical.
Always takes me out of it. Boy, that montage always takes me out of it.
Yeah, that's a tough moment there.
Also, seeing a bicycle in a Western kind of takes me out of it. It's so odd.
Well, but there were bicycles back then. I'm sure.
How often do you see a Western hero or villain on a bicycle?
Rarely, I'll give you that. It's very rare. But nevertheless, other than that montage, I also like the ending. The very, they're pinned down. The bank robbery's gone to hell. They're surrounded by the army. And it's just a classic. Let's do this, run out, freeze frame, fade to black, run credits. And, one always hopes they made it, but one knows their life is doomed. The buddies are doomed from a life of traveling through the West and being chased. And
what year was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
I think,
69, right? Wasn't it 69?
69.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, this is the funny story I have for you. My number four is also 1969. And I recalled so fondly that ending of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And then when I watched it again, and it's as you described, but when I watched it again a few years back, I said, mm-hmm. Wait a minute, this is not quite as powerful or as I remember it. And then a couple years back, I went and saw Restored the Wild Bunch at the Arclight. Hadn't seen that in many years. And I went, wait a minute. This is the ending I was giving Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid credit for. Because it's similar endings. But the ending to Wild Bunch is just a little more elegiac and a little more kind of death-defying in terms of the part of the filmmakers, as you would expect from Sam Peckinpah, spitting in the face of death and the fates. So The Wild Bunch is my number four, directed by Sam Peckinpah, starring William Holden, one of the great stars. Ernest Borgnine, again, Robert Ryan, who I mentioned, what a wonderful actor, especially in film noir, war, westerns, these very masculine-seeming genres. He always brought such a flawed nature to these that was so interesting while still being a very tough guy. Edmund O'Brien again, Warren Oates, Jaime Sanchez, Ben Johnson, on and on and on. Just an amazing cast, including future filmmaker future Oscar-winning filmmaker Alfonso Arau. So this film is, I think, set later than any film I have on my list. It's set in 1913. You even do see automobiles in it.
Automobiles and a Gatling gun, too.
The leader of a gang of aging outlaws, Pike Bishop, played by William Holden, is seeking retirement with one final score, the robbery of a railroad office containing a cache of silver. And the gang is ambushed by Pike's former partner, Deke Thornton, who is basically now being forced by the railroads to lead a posse of bounty hunters that have been deputized by the railroad. And so there is a bloody and lengthy cat and mouse chase that heads all the way into Mexico as the result.
Yeah.
It was the 17th highest grossing film of 1969 and one the New York Times called the first truly exciting American Western in many years. To this day, it's still noted for its intricate multi-angle quick-cut editing using both normal and slow-motion images, which was
stretching out those
revolutionary in 69 and still really cool and still speaks to a contemporary audience today.
And it seems like it's what John Woo has taken, like if he's learned anything from an American movie.
Well, I would say it's Peckinpah and Leone, right?
Yeah.
Become John Woo.
Absolutely.
It got an Academy Award nomination for Best Screenplay. It got a Directors Guild nomination for Best Director, also on the National Film Registry. And, you know, just it still packs a wall up. And it's still resonant, this idea of there being in contemporary corporate society, because here's a film where that's what the railroad represents, is the end of rugged individualism.
And you're aging and the embracing of getting old.
Yeah, in corporate America, there's no room for the individual. There's no room for the aging. And therefore, we root on anyone who embodies both those things, even if they're criminal.
Right.
So it's
true.
It's still very resonant. What do you have at number three, Dean Haglund?
Well, The Wild Bunch, oddly enough. And my add to that is I saw Ernest Borgnine live introduce this movie at the Million Dollar Theater right on Broadway in downtown Los Angeles. This was about 2 years before he died. And told some fascinating trivia tidbits, including that his limp in the movie, that seems like such a fantastic acting choice, wasn't an acting choice, but in fact he had broke his ankle doing another movie before that and had to wear a cast while shooting on location in Mexico. So if you look at him limping, that's really him injured.
It's one of the things that I talk about in my acting class all the time, right? Have faith that what has come forward to serve your character, because it serves his character. He doesn't try to hide it. They don't try to mask it. It becomes a part of that character's unique physicality and tells a story about the life they've lived.
Yeah, it's so true. And he said they fired about 90,000 blanks during the filming of that thing. So it was just a massive gunfight and lots of bullets flying around.
They may have been firing blanks, but they hit a bullseye.
Don't even call that the quote.
My number three, Dean Haglund, is Unforgiven. From 1992. And it's appropriately number three because it was the third Western in the history of cinema to win Best Picture. Only three in 1931. Cimarron, of course, a couple years earlier, Dances with Wolves, that seems quite forgotten. And now Unforgiven, which wins a Best Picture and has only seen its reputation grow since then.
Yeah.
Directed by Clint Eastwood, starring Clint Eastwood, Morgan Freeman, Gene Hackman, Richard Harris, Francis Fisher, Saul Rubinek, all doing amazing, amazing character work. Written by David Webb Peebles, the man who wrote Blade Runner. And damn if there aren't a lot of thematic similarities between those films about bounty hunting and the dangers of allowing even right-minded police officers to do their work in the context of a police state. Unforgiven follows a story where a prostitute gets cut up by a pair of cowboys in the town of Big Whiskey, Wyoming. Her fellow brothel workers post a reward for their murder, much to the displeasure of the town's sheriff, Little Bill Daggett, played by Gene Hackman, who does not condone vigilanteism in his town. And so he outlaws guns. Nevertheless, two groups of gunfighters, one led by aging former bandit Will Money, played by Clint Eastwood, the other by the florid English Bob, who is a hired killer paid for by the railroad to kill their former workers so that they don't owe them money. They come to town hoping to collect the reward, and they clash with each other and with the sheriff. And it is not only the third Western film to win Best Picture, not only the 11th biggest hit of 1992, spending 3 weeks at number one on the box office long before any of the award nominations came out. And not only did it receive near universal acclaim, and not only has its reputation only grown since then, but at the time it was made, it was about Chief Daryl Gates of Los Angeles. And about how here was a decorated lawman who had, quote unquote, good intentions. And yet, you know, his politics were such that he believed, because he was on the right side of things, he ought to be judge and jury and executioner. And Clint Eastwood, no less than the guy who played Dirty Harry, understands the danger of this, understands the danger of a police state. And yet, here it resonates even more today. And why? Because this movie was Black Lives Matter in 1992. It was feminist.
Absolutely.
It was feminist in 1992. It was a thrilling, elegiac, anti-violence piece.
Absolutely, it's hard to kill somebody. This is the thing that none of these Westerns up till this time had ever pointed out, that killing a man is hard. That's what the characters say. That's what the characters go through. You see them
not only
wavering.
Not only is it hard, it says that whether the person pulling the trigger is good or bad or somewhere in between, what they are doing by pulling that trigger will bring nothing but harm, all on account of pulling a trigger. I once was involved in the making of the documentary on the 10th anniversary of Unforgiven, and that was the title that we were given by Mr. Eastwood to name the documentary, All on Account of Pulling a Trigger. And that is a statement that only someone with the track record of violence in the movies, like Clint Eastwood, could make, could make, so that it would be received by all audiences.
Absolutely.
So
and
number,
you know,
three is Unforgiven.
And that's my number two, oddly enough. So, again, it's amazing that he had this read the script some 15 years before 1992, and he had purchased it, bought the option, and hung on to it till he was old enough to play that character. So he knew that this thing was so compelling and was so right for him. There was no other actor and no other time in history that could undo the damage of the mythos that he himself perpetrated through the good, the bad, the ugly, through a lot of the other Westerns that he did, that made The Unforgiven so compelling. And still to this day, I think it would resonate more now. I haven't seen it in about 5 years, but I think I might take another watch.
It does. Politically, it resonates more. Acting-wise, it resonates more. And also, the fact that it's Clint Eastwood's last Western. Not only did he wait but till he was old enough and right for the role, but until he was done making any other Westerns. Because he knew this had to be the conclusion thematically. And when other Western scripts have come his way, he's refused to look at them because he said, there is no way now that I can make any Western that won't in some way be repeating myself.
Right.
And this
That's
was
true.
Not a repeat. If it ever did touch on similar moments, it was a comment on what had come before.
Well, sir, you are a cowardly son of a bitch. You just shot an unarmed man.
Well, he should have armed himself.
My number two is that other Sergio Leone movie, Dean Haglund. The Good and the Bad and the Ugly from 1966, starring Clint Eastwood, Lee Van Cleef, Eli Wallach, an epic Italian spaghetti western, a co-production between companies in Italy, Spain, West Germany, and the U.S. This film really is the one that, you know, made Sergio Leone style known worldwide, specifically his use of long shots cut together with close-up cinematography, a style I found myself using a lot at times, oddly enough, in The Lady Killers. And as you pointed out to me, it was somewhat appropriate because there are so many scenes in The Good and the Bad and the Ugly that are structured and executed like comedic scenes set up as jokes, one of which will actually close this show today after the closing music. Of course, Ennio Morricone's score is instantly recognizable. Electric guitar in that song. I was thinking about that when I was listening to the song. How jarring it is, actually, in context to all these other Westerns I've been watching, to hear an electric guitar on the score.
As opposed to an acoustic strumming out on the on the windswept prairie, there's an electric guitar jarring.
The plot revolves around three gunslingers competing to find fortune in a buried cache of Confederate gold amid the violent chaos of the American Civil War, specifically the New Mexico campaign of 1862. They participate in many battles and duels along the way. It was the third collaboration between Leone and Clint Eastwood, the second with Lee Van Cleef. It was marketed as the third and final installment in the Dollars trilogy, following A Fistful of Dollars and For a Few Dollars More. And they're really fun, and you should really watch them to enjoy the development of the style and the working relationships. But they're in name only sequels. They're maybe thematic sequels, but not character based sequels. The film was a huge hit, grossing over $25 million at the box office that year, despite general disapproval of the entire spaghetti Western genre by critics at that time.
Right. They saw it as cheap and poorly subbed and dubbed. And
ultra violent. And the way the close-ups would shove your face in the violence, the way the editing would ratchet up the tension to make it unbearable, critics did not like that. For many of the same reasons that critics don't like horror, which we talked about before. They don't like being surprised, critics. They like being smarter than the material. Mm-hmm. They like movies that affirm how smart they are. And when something creates real tension in a viewer, they're often going to be surprised by something. And I don't think critics initially like to be surprised. They like to know what they're going to see. Not all, but some. That is a trap that some critics have historically had. It's now, of course, gained critical acclaim throughout the world and is seen as highly influential and one of the greatest films of all time. And it's important, this film. It reminds me that times, that eras, that struggles are mythic. The times, the eras, the struggles we find ourselves in are mythic. We are in mythic waters of creation. And yet that the people like us who inhabit these times and struggles are all human. We're all flawed. We are all, each and every one of us, good, bad, and ugly. What's your number one, Dean Haglund?
Well, talking about myth and the deconstruction of that and the mythology and how you go into it, and also to celebrate that, to be a fandom of it. For my number one, the movie that does such a complex job, I think, is the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Now, this is Brad Pitt playing Jesse James, which I have a cool side story to that. And then Casey Affleck coming as the guy who either is idolizing him or he's just a weirdo, creepy, he's going to kill him from the get-go. It plays on so many levels of the myth being deconstructed of Jesse James himself by Jesse James himself, knowing that in order for his myth to continue, he will have to be shot by someone. And how also unknown to me was that after Robert Ford shot him, he went on the road and did 140 shows of a play playing himself assassinating Jesse James.
Wow.
Like, to me, I know. Think of that. Like, immediately after you kill the guy, you go on the road. Now, the side story to this is I was at a UFO convention in south of Dallas in a small town, not Galveston. The name escapes me. But there was a cemetery where the headstone read Jesse James. And the tour guide who was there said, this is one of three tombstones that say Jesse James on it. And this is the only one that's still paid for by the family for upkeep. And if you look at the date of when he died, 1951, because it is believed, this is the myth-making ability, Jesse James faked his death, was his own pallbearer, and that placed it all on Robert Ford so that he could live out the rest of his life separate from the Jesse James gunslinger myth and live a happy life till 1951 when he was in his 80s.
And therefore, then Robert Ford would have had to be the most trusted of his companions,
yeah,
right? Because he would cover it up, and he would gain, as you said, he would gain from it. Although it is possible, a la The Gunfighter, that Gregory Peck movie I was referencing, that he's setting up Robert Ford for a life of misery. I mean, there's no way of knowing it, because wouldn't people have been gunning for the man who gunned down Jesse James?
Well, that's the thing. But in the myth, he's shot in the back of the head. So, in fact, there's a popular song at the time, and they show that in the movie, of a song, Coward Robert Ford, and he's called a coward wherever he goes.
So why would you shoot a coward? Exactly. You wouldn't gain any notoriety by shooting a coward.
Wouldn't get
fascinating.
And he dies. Yeah, Robert Ford dies an alcoholic at the end of it, because obviously the psychic pressure.
And yet he was able to make a lot of money performing the assassination over and over again.
I know.
Which means that he made more money off of it than the movie The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Okay, my number one, as we carry into the 70-minute mark of this episode of your Joe Pack Hollywood Hour Plus.
We had so much to talk about.
We did have so much to talk about. My number one, The Searchers from 1956.
Oh, really?
Directed by John Ford, starring John Wayne, Jeffrey Hunter.
Yeah.
That's Captain Christopher Pike to you and me. Vera Miles, Natalie Wood, Ward Bond, Hank Warden, who would later be known as the waiter in Twin Peaks. They told me about you. Anyway, The Searchers is a 1956 American Technicolor VistaVision Western. It's based on the 54 novel by Alan LeMay, set during the Texas Indian Wars, and starring John Wayne as a middle-aged Civil War veteran who spends years looking for his abducted niece, played by Natalie Wood, accompanied by his adoptive nephew, played by Jeffrey Hunter. As critic Roger Ebert once wrote, this is, without a doubt, John Wayne's most complex, compelling character. And, interesting side note, his catchphrase, "That'll be the day," inspired Buddy Holly's biggest hit.
Oh, I knew that.
The film was a commercial success, although it received no Academy Award nominations at its time. Since its release, of course, it's come to be considered a masterpiece, one of the most influential films ever made. It was remade twice as Paul Schrader's Hardcore and as Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. It was named the greatest American Western by the American Film Institute in 2008, placed 12th on the British Film Institute Sight and Sound magazine poll as the greatest. AFI made it 12th of all movies of all time. The British Film Institute Sight and Sound ranked it as the 7th best film of all time. And the French magazine Cahiers du Cinéma ranked it number 10 of the greatest films of all time. And these are all within the last few years. Right. At the time, one of the things that made people uncomfortable was its politics, because the movie was about the Brown versus Board of Education desegregation decision. That's what the movie is about. That's what it's talking about. It's wrestling with all the players in it. So it's about racial integration and desegregation. It also was about the challenges of reconstruction of our union in the wake of desegregation. And of course, it used the metaphor of the reconstruction of the Civil War to do that. Well, guess where we are 60 years literally later. It still speaks to the racism of today, to the challenges of integrating society, to the Civil War of today. You all can do the math. Beyond that, there never has been and probably never will be a Western protagonist as fascinating as John Wayne's Ethan in The Searchers. And it's just about the most beautiful film you could possibly look at. Every single frame of that is like a painting that should be hung in a museum.
It's true. Those sweeping vistas. And I believe that was shot out in New Mexico and Arizona. You've never seen it so grand, particularly if you see it on the big screen, which I did.
How about the opening shot? How about the opening shot? It's darkness. And instead of a fade in, a doorway opens. And we realize we're in a darkened house. And the doorway opens. People walk out to greet John Wayne, who's approaching the house. We then, for the rest of the movie, will follow John Wayne as he attempts to restore civilization where these savage undertakings, these brutal undertakings have taken place, where he will respond with brutality and savagery and inhumanity in his attempt to restore civilization. And once he successfully restores civilization, what happens? We're back to that opening shot, only now everyone comes in and the door closes on John Wayne, because there may be a place for that kind of brutality and violence in terms of rescuing civilization, but there is no place for it within civilization.
How about that? And an interesting note, that final shot, his gesture, putting his one hand on the elbow of the opposite arm, is in reference to a silent film Western star named Tom Mix, who, and that was his signature move in all the silent Westerns. And John Wayne reiterated that in The Searchers as a tribute to Tom Mix.
Speaking of signatures, it's time for us to sign off. We have a special closing that we'll play in just a moment. For now, I will say that's the end of another exciting installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can find every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, thanks to the fine people at Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back with a new show next week. Until then, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
From the moment a girl gets to be full grown, the very first thing she learns, when two men go out to face each other, only one returns. The bravest of them all. The man who shot Liberty Valance, he shot Liberty Valance, he was the bravest of them all.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
When you have to shoot, shoot, don't talk.
Belated spoiler alert.